I'm going to stop talking and welcome our speaker, David Nesenoff. Please put your hands together.
Thank you, Rabbi. I turned it on. Okay. It's on to record. It's good to go. Okay. Let me put this over here. Thank you all for coming. There's nothing else to do in Atlanta on a Saturday night. It's very nice. I spoke Friday night. I was here today during the lunch, speaking tonight. I'll be here all week, speaking every day, just up here, coming anytime you want. Usually I take a picture to prove to my wife where I was, but she's here, so. So I don't need the picture, but I'm going to do it anyway. Everybody, let's go. Hello. L'chaim, this is a picture, not a video. So, L'chaim.
I'm an upgrade.
So, okay. Here we go. By the way, I mentioned earlier, when I spoke last night, I think, that when you get off the plane and you're talking to someone for an hour, 2 hours, or 5 hours, your head's like this. You know, so I don't want that to happen to you here either. If you're able to turn your chair around, don't sit like that. Turn it around, get comfortable. If you're still eating, stop eating already. So enough. Good. Turn your chair around, get comfortable. We're not going to be here so long, but still. So my wife and I are happy to be here. I can't tell you how thrilled we're to be here. We live in Florida, so we're so thrilled to be here in Atlanta. Beautiful. We actually had beautiful weather the last couple of days. We had the pleasure of going to the aquarium and to the Coca-Cola Museum. It was very nice. I highly recommend it. It's worth 10 minutes. It's really very 10 minutes of my life that I'll never get back. It was very nice. It was very nice. We loved it, really. So we're originally, by the way, not from Florida. We're originally from New York. The Jews start in New York. They go to Florida. And then when the Mashiach comes, we go to Miami. So when we lived in New York, we lived in Suffolk County. We lived out in Long Island, Suffolk County. Good, okay. Very good. And our daughter Shira had gone to the Salman Schechter Day School there. It was the Jewish day school for a little while. She was very young, and the school closed. We couldn't support it. It wasn't so many Jews, and the school closed. So we had to put her into public school. Okay, and we were very nervous putting in a public school, coming from this warm Jewish school. Now she's going to be in public school. So the first day of public school, I went to pick her up. I wanted to find out everything. You know, how's this school? What's going on? She shouldn't take the big, bad school bus. You know, she's going to come in my private car, get in the back seat, and tell me everything. So I pick her up the first day of school, public school, and she gets in the back seat. And I ask her that question that every Jewish parent asks their kid. New? New means tell me everything immediately. I want to know. So I said, new? And she said from the back seat, her little voice said, there are three Christians in my class. I said, what? She said, there are three Christians in my class. I said, who told you that? The teacher. The teacher told you the three Christians? Yeah. The teacher told you or the whole class? The whole class. The teacher stood up in front of the room and said, there are three Christians. Yeah. My mind is spinning. Did the teacher say how many Jews or Hindus or Muslims are in the class? No. My mind is really spent. I'm thinking, okay, this is anti-Semitic, whatever it is. I'm going to call the teacher, the principal, the superintendent of the schools. I'm calling Abe Foxman at the ADL. I'm getting all excited. I'm really frustrated. And my daughter sees I'm getting all upset. And she says, what are you getting so upset about? My teacher just said there are three boys in the class who all have the same name, Christian. And if you wonder why I have no hair left after raising these children, I mention it because tonight the word anti-Semitism may come up, and I just want to tell you, not everything is anti-Semitic, okay? Sometimes there are three boys in the class named Christian, leave it, okay? That's it. Sometimes a Jew could be wearing a yarmulke and driving down the Long Island Expressway going 100 miles an hour and gets pulled over by the police. Maybe it wasn't the yarmulke, it was the 100 miles an hour. I'm just saying, okay? Although I did fight it, I was in court for 2 weeks. You know. So that was me. Yeah, that was me. So some people know me. I spoke here a number of years ago. for something that I did, something that happened to me, and it has to do with the word, the name Helen Thomas. You may remember Helen Thomas. I was the one that interviewed her at the White House that got her thrown out of the White House, and that was my big claim to fame. People wonder what happened there. I'll briefly. All over the world, people are clapping when I said Helen. You know, I was actually, after it happened, I was at the airport. I wasn't going to say this, but I was at Kennedy Airport going to Israel afterwards. And I'm sitting at the airport, you know, thinking about all the things that happened to me about Helen Thomas and the whole story. And I noticed across from me, there were like 100 Hasidic Jews, you know, also going to Israel. They weren't Chabad. They were a different brand, you know. And they were over there. And so they're over there, and they start noticing me and looking at me. I guess they recognize me from the news and everything. And they start pointing and looking and nonchalantly walking over to me, like I wouldn't notice 100 Hasidic Jews. And I'm sitting there, you know, like, what now? What now? You know. And they start circling me. They got their phones on, and they're circling me. It was like a slow-motion horror, you know. And one finally leans over to me, and he leans in my face, and he says, "Are you the guy? You Washington? 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 The guy in the Washington?" I said, "Yeah, yeah, I'm Washington. I'm the guy Washington. Yeah, yeah." And they all start dancing. Hey, Simintov, Ochosin, Kale, Mazel Tov. So that's my claim to fame. I threw out this anti-Semite from the White House. Okay. So what happened was I was actually, I had been a conservative rabbi for many years before I became Chabad. People always ask, how do you go from Chabad to conservative rabbi Chabad? And I mentioned earlier today, it's not such a difficult story. It's a Chabad rabbi came over and said, "Do you like cake?" I said, "Yeah." And I had cake 3 times this weekend and in 700 Chabad houses in the world. So I've been to over 700 Chabad. So it's not such a difficult. It's like what your story also. You know, Chabad rabbi came out. You're Jewish. You like cake. Yeah, come. So it's not such a big. So I was leaving my conservative congregation, and I was thinking about what can I do with the rest of my life. Sometimes we have these moments of, what, you know, what am I going to do? Well, who am I? If you turn off Facebook for just a minute and you look at the computer, you'll actually see your face in the reflection, okay? You'll look at yourself, who am I? What do I want to do? And Israel was on my mind. It's always on our mind. Every time in decades and decades, there's always something going on. And I thought, what can I do for my poor Israel? I'm going to go ahead. I'm a filmmaker. I'm going to take a film, and I'm going to go around asking people about Israel. And then I'm going to put it online, push the button, it's going to go viral, and everybody's going to see it, and everyone's going to love Israel. I'm going to ask them, "Oh, tell me about Israel." They'll say, "The falafel's good, Masada's good, oh, it's wonderful, the Kotel, the Western Wall." And that's what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. My wife came in the office, and she said, "That's what you're going to do?" I said, "Yes." She said, "Is there dental? Anything, money, something?" I said, "Well, I'll work that out next." So anyway, I went, my son, who was a teenager at the time, and he was very involved in communications and everything. And so he called up the White House. Somehow he had their number. This kid is, and he calls up, he leaves a message. They have a tape machine there, pal. And he said, "I'd like to come next Hanukkah and film the Hanukkah menorah lighting at the White House." It was like June, and this was next December. He leaves a message. The White House calls him back. And they say, "Adam, we're a little confused. Did you mean you want to come next Hanukkah, or you mean you want to come next week for Jewish Heritage Day?" And he says, "Next week for Jewish Heritage Day." And it is a proud moment in every parent's life when your children learn how to lie correctly, you know. So he gets 3 press passes to the White House for Jewish Heritage Day. And we go down there, and we're walking around, and, you know, seeing the Jewish Heritage Day was in the afternoon. We got there in the morning, but they let us in, which I couldn't believe. And we walked around, and the Jewish Heritage Day started all the festivities in the afternoon, but the morning had other things. I think Duke University won the basketball. There were a lot of tall guys there. I couldn't really see what was going on, but something happened there. And we're walking around, and the Jews weren't there yet. There was one loose Jew on the White House lawn, though. He was walking around. It was a Chabad rabbi. There was a Chabad rabbi loose on the White House lawn. And I couldn't believe he was there for Jewish Heritage Day, because a Chabad rabbi doesn't come hours early to anything, okay? I figured he thought it was yesterday and he's coming now. So I went up to him, and he was the mashgiach at the White House. He was very involved in the White House from all the different presidents. Anyway, so we're also walking around, and sure enough, who do I see? I was on the phone. The first thing I had to do, by the way, when I was in the press room, you know that press room that everybody goes to, you always see? So I'm in the press room, and the first thing I had to do was get on the phone and call everybody up and tell them where I was. Yeah, I'm at the White House today. Yeah, I'm at the White House. I can't make it to that meeting. There's no meeting? Well, I'm at the White House today. I'm just telling everybody I'm at the White House. So as I'm doing this, I see walking by, President Clinton was visiting. It was Obama in the White House, but President Clinton walked by. And I couldn't believe it. So President Clinton walked by. I go, President Clinton! He goes, and he walks by. And I'm all excited that I saw President Clinton walk by. I don't know. So I turn to the next guy who walks by. I go, that's President Clinton! And the guy says, I know. I'm Joe Biden. I know. And he did spend most of the day walking around telling people, I'm Joe Biden. So that was my morning there. But finally, we're walking around. And who do I see on the front lawn of the White House? Helen Thomas. I only knew her as... She's a very famous journalist. She was the dean of the Washington Press Corps. She was there in the White House for 60 years. She was there since Eisenhower. Okay, she's been there. She's 89. I think she dated Lincoln's younger brother or something. I mean, she's there a long time. And I thought, you know, I've been a journalist now for 60 seconds. She's been a journalist for 60 years. I thought it was time we met. So I went running over to her with my son and his friend. We had the press passes. And I figured, you know, I'm going to change my whole life around by asking Jews this question of tell me something about Israel. Any comments on Israel? I figured, oh, let me start with this one. I didn't know who she was. You know, I knew she's famous. Ran over to her, told her we're in the White House. Put this little camera. I had the little flip camera. Put it in front of her. And I said... by the way, my luck, the second I put the camera up, they start mowing the lawn, you know, on the front lawn of the White House. I'm like, how does this happen? Who's in charge of that? I figure, you know, Michelle says to Barack, you know, the Jews are coming today, the lawn is a mess, get out. And Barack's out there, you know, pushing the... So anyway, so you hear in the background, so I had to move the camera really close to her face. It's another story. So we put it really close to her face. And people later said, that's his style of filmmaking. He likes close to the face. It was a lawnmower. Yeah. So I put it there, but I wanted to get the sound, you know. So sure enough, I say to her, any comments on Israel? And she said, tell him to get the hell out of Palestine. And I said, ooh. A week later, I was on Fox News and CNN and everything else. And they said, Rabbi Nesanoff, when you said ooh, what were you thinking? And I said, I was thinking ooh. So sure enough, I said to her, I said, tell them to get the hell out of Palestine. I said, where should they go? And she said, home. And because I asked the next question, I'm here today visiting and speaking to all of you and spending Shabbos. I said, where's home? And she said, Poland and Germany. End of story. Poland and Germany. I wish I could go back to my grandparents, Shtetlach, their towns in Poland and Germany. I wish I could go back and see Shabbos candles lit by every home, every Jewish home. Challah, the smell of challah from every Jewish home. Kiddush here from every Jewish home. But they're gone. They're exterminated. Those towns are not there. Most of those Jews are not there. My name, David, is for Davosya, who is buried in Babi Yar with 100,000 Jews. They're gone. Tell them to go home. So I went back with this information. I did say a few more words to her, and then I asked her if she knows anything about the Arab and Israeli conflict, and she said she's from a Lebanese background. I spoke to her in Arabic. She didn't speak Arabic, but Rabbi Nesanoff speaks Arabic, so the whole thing was a mess. Anyway, I went back, and I needed to post this. I think I should post this. I first went to a journalist, a Jewish journalist, and told him about it, and he said, no news, nothing. So I thought, you know, but it's kind of rang true to me that something should be done with it. So I wanted to post it, but this is a number of years ago, and still today, you know, if I had to post something, anybody has to post something, nobody knows how to post anything. You need a 16-year-old child to post it, okay? And if you can afford it, get a 12-year-old, but who can afford a 12-year-old? So I said, okay, we'll wait. My son was graduating high school, so he wasn't free. Every night there was a different driver ed, chemistry, whatever it was. He couldn't post it. Finally, a week later, the flotilla from Turkey happens. Flotilla from Turkey happens. Terrorists come over on a boat from Turkey trying to go into Gaza. And Israel wants to inspect the boat. They go without any weapons by rope onto the boat from helicopters. The Arab terrorists take metal rods and beat them as they come down and throw some of the soldiers overboard. Finally, one Israeli had a six shooter on. It was almost an antique. And he defended himself and he shot one of the terrorists. The whole world condemned Israel. Israel. Helen Thomas stood up in the front row seat of the White House, center row that she owned, and she said, it was a deliberate massacre by the Israelis on the high seas against peace activists. And that would be the last time she ever stood, spoke, or said anything in the White House. The next day, my son had some time. We posted the video. It was a Thursday night, a Friday. We finally posted it. I turned off the computer for Shabbos. Moitzei Shabbos, Saturday night. I turned on the computer to see if anybody watched the thing. We had over 700,000 views at that time. That's just the people that didn't observe Shabbos. By Sunday, thing went crazy, viral, millions. By Monday, the news was all over it. Because this is, journalists write about a lot of things, but they certainly write about journalists, and they certainly write about the most famous journalist in the world who said such a thing. So Monday, my computer is blowing up. I'm getting thousands and thousands of requests from journalists. I received ultimately 20,000 death threats and hate mails. But the journalists were going crazy. Everybody wanted to speak to who's the guy that was behind the camera. And I'm sitting in my son's, you know, room with his computer with the soccer wallpaper, you know, number one story in the world, going, what do I do now? And the phone rings. You know, I said, God, what do I do? The phone rang. It was Ari Fleischer, former President Bush's White House press secretary. He calls, Yasher Koach, Rabbi Nesanov. I said, thank you. I said, what can I do? I said, what do I do? What do I do with all this? What's happening? He said, listen, you're going to be all over the news. You have to have a message. If you don't have a message, they'll make up a message. You better have a message. I said, Ari, what's my message? He said, I can't tell you your message. You have to figure out what your message is. I thank you very much. I spoke to him a number of times. Very nice man. My son comes home from school, and I tell him, Ari Fleischer called. And my son says, I know. I told him to call you. Who is this kid? I said, well, he called, and he said, we need a message. What's our message? My son said, we're not smart enough to think of a message. We have to get some advice. I said, well, who do we call? He says, your number one story in the world today. You can call anybody you want in the world. They'll take your call. Okay, who do you want to call to find out what our message is? So I'm thinking, oh, it's a story about anti-Semitism. It's go back to Germany, the Holocaust. It's political. I said one name. Elie Wiesel. Bring me Elie Wiesel. My son said, you want to speak to Elie Wiesel? I said, yes. He said, okay. He left the room. Seconds later, he walks in. Here's Elie Wiesel. He hands me the phone. He said, Professor Wiesel, Yasher Koach, Rabbi Nesanov. I know it sounds like Ari Fleischer. I can only do one imitation. He said, Yasher Koach, Rabbi Nesanov. I said, oh, thank you, Elie Wiesel. He said, I told him, I'm getting a lot of hate mail and death threats. And he says to me, I get a lot of that too. He said to me, there is evil in the world. Coming from Elie Wiesel, I listened to it carefully. I said to him, what's my message? And he said something interesting. He said, I was reading about you in the paper this morning. Now, my whole world is being crazy now. Elie Wiesel is sitting having a cup of Sanka and a Danish, you know, reading about me. You know, the whole thing is just crazy. What's going on? And he says, I read that you pray with Chabad. Yeah, I was a conservative rabbi, but I prayed with Chabad. You need a minion, you know. So I prayed with Chabad. So I said, yeah, I prayed with Chabad. He says, why don't you find out what the Lubavitcher Rebbe would have wanted you to say? He's not in this world now, but what would he want you to say? I said, thank you very much. Thanked Elie Wiesel very much. Oliver Shalom, he should rest in peace. And I went to my Chabad house the next morning and to daven. And now I have I'm telling you, my whole life changed. I have an entourage now. There's a guy carrying my talis bag, my tefillin, I'm walking in, you know, the whole thing. You know, I'm on the phone the whole time. I say, wrap me up, you know, I'll be with you in a minute. You know. So I say to Rabbi Chaim Grossbaum, who's the shaliach, who's the rabbi in Stony Brook, Long Island, where I was, I told him, Ari Fleischer said I need a message, and Elie Wiesel said I should find out what the Lubavitcher Rebbe wants me to say on television. And this is why I love Chabad. You know, these rabbis, they don't just go, oh, that's very nice. They go, okay, let's take care of it. Let's go. Let's do it. Let's find out. And we went and we called up Avram Shemtov, okay? A rabbi who was involved with Washington, with the White House, very well-respected Chabad rabbi who would know what the message is. And he called. He knew when he heard who was on the phone, he heard about him. He knew the whole story, of course. And he spoke to me, and he gave me a message. And because you nice folks came out tonight and you had the celebrating the end of Shabbos together, I'm going to have the privilege of telling you this very short message. It's just a few words. But this is the message he said, and it's what... He was right on target of what as they said in England, where I'm going in a few weeks, he was spot on of what the Rebbe would say. It's like this. If you have a friend and your friend goes away for a year, is that still your friend? Sure, still my friend. If your friend goes away for 4 years, is it still your friend? Yeah, sure, 4 years, still my friend. If you don't see your friend in 50 years, still your friend? Well, maybe it's not my friend, it's somebody I knew. But if you have a child Your child goes away for a year, still your child, of course. 4 years, still your child, yes. If you don't see chas v'shalom, chalil v'chas, God forbid, for whatever reason, you don't see your child for 50 years, is that still your child? Of course. And he said this, the Rebbe says, we are not the friends of Israel. We are b'nei Yisrael. We are the children of Israel. And we could be away for 4 years in Auschwitz. We could be away for 50 years. We could be away for thousands of years in Golos in the diaspora. But the children of Israel, the land of Israel, and the God of Israel are always connected. And what this woman and what other people don't understand is that the relationship between children of Israel and the Father God of Israel and the land of Israel are forever. It is a forever relationship. There have been always Jews in the land of Israel in their connection with God. And I gave the, I was then booked Sunday morning to be on Howard Kurtz's Reliable Sources on CNN. I sat there all patched up, ready to go on the air. And I don't know what the first question was, but I knew the answer. The children of Israel and the God of Israel. And then he asked me another question. And I said, did I mention the children of Israel? And that was my message. I went all around the world. I was asked to speak at the Yale University Global Symposium on Anti-Semitism. Oddly enough, I had traveled the whole country. And then when I came back, there was a letter. You know, how did they? There was a letter waiting for me. And when I speak to college audiences, by the way, I have to slow down at this point and explain what a letter is. You know, a, you rip it open. Do you click it? No, you don't click it. You rip it open. You take out the... So, and it was from Yale University, this letter. So the first thing I did when I got this letter from Yale was I called my mother. I said, Mom, do you remember when Yale didn't accept me to college? Now they want me to come and teach there. So I went to, actually I called up Yale and I told them, I'm very honored, I'm putting you on a waiting list. So I went to Yale. And you know, by the way, sometimes things happen outside the big auditorium before you get on than even in the auditorium. So I'm waiting outside to go on to speak at Yale University. And this guy comes running over to me and says, are you Rabbi Nesanoff? I said, yes I am. He says, I thought that was you. I said, it's me. He said, I admire what you did. So I said, well, thank you very much. He said, but my wife, not so much. I said, oh, your wife likes Helen Thomas? He said, oh, nothing to do with Helen Thomas. 5 years ago, you officiated at our wedding. You can't make this stuff up. Yeah. So I spoke at Yale. Charles Osher Small, the chairman of the Symposium of Anti-Semitism at Yale University, he introduced me. Before he introduced me, he said, I'd like to tell you exactly why I asked David Nesanoff to be the keynote speaker. And I got to tell you, I was very interested to find out as well. I was interested. So he said, I never watched television. I was at my parents' house and I saw on CNN this rabbi come on and he said, the children of Israel, and he quoted the exact words of the Rebbe, the children of Israel are children and there's a land of Israel, a God of Israel, a father of Israel, and this connection is unbreakable, it's forever. He said, that's the story we have to tell. That's the message. That is the truth and that has to be said. It's not always said. We're always saying other stories. We have to tell the God story, the children's story, the land story. And I spent my time going to over 700 Chabad houses in the world, throughout the United States, all campuses. I went to South America, to Uruguay, Paraguay, all the Guays, and Sao Paulo, Rio, Curitiba, Argentina, Buenos Aires. I spoke for 4,000 Jews in Buenos Aires. They had a translator. Some people had the thing in their ear. Some people spoke English. There, when I spoke, if I said something funny, people laughed, and then 5 seconds later, the rest of the room laughed. It was kind of a weird situation going on. So, but it was, you know, it was an honor to do so. So, but what happened now is what do we do today? I mean, this was, we have some anti-Semitism going on today, and I don't tell my dad, we're all experts on anti-Semitism, but I have a feeling for it and a flavor for it. So Hoshana Rabbah, this past year, in Sukkot, you know, Sukkot, we sit outside in the Sukkot and we have a good time. The last day of Sukkot, I'm sitting outside in Boca Raton, Florida, in my son's sukkah. And we're all a bunch of men gathered there talking and telling stories. Each one's trying to, you know, sound intelligent more than the other, telling something about Torah and about sukkahs and about the holiday and even bring up Rosh Hashanah. We're all talking in the sukkah. And then our rabbi, our shaliach, we have a rabbi in Boca, Rabbi Zalman Bucket. His name is Zalman Bucket. He shows up and, you know, we all stop and he walks in and he announces that it's his brother's yurtzeit. It's his brother's yurtzeit. Yurtzeit, you know, the anniversary of his brother's death. Now, I remember he lost a brother in Israel during COVID. But he said, no, this is a different brother. This brother died at the age of 19, many, many years ago, he said, and I never met him. I said, oh. He said he was institutionalized his entire life. He was actually, he said the word, he was a vegetable. His entire life in an institution for 19 years, and I never met him, and he died, and today is the anniversary of his death. So I said, wow. Okay, I didn't know this about the rabbi, but that's, you know, very tragic and sad. And then he said, when I came 30 years ago to Florida, I went to Century Village. Before I opened my own Chabad house, I was the rabbi in Century Village. They had a synagogue. You know Century Village? It's because everybody there is between 95 and 105. They call it Century Village. Okay, that's how many years the congregants have been around for. So he said he was there. One of his first Shabbos is there in Century Village. And a guy comes up to him. He's in his 90s. Some guy in his 90s comes up to him. And he says he was the doctor that delivered his brother who died at 19. Said he was, and he said, I'm the doctor. He said, Rabbi Bucket was very amazed. He didn't even know. He said, oh. And then he said, the doctor said, and I want you to know, he was in breach. Now, Rabbi Bucket didn't know anything about this birth. He said, baby was in breach. And I tried at the time to deliver him and turn him around. And I did something I shouldn't have done or whatever. And I disconnected the spinal cord and pulled him out. And that's what caused him to be dysfunctioning his entire life before he died at 19. Now, Rabbi Bucket telling us the story, he was saying how he was amazed to hear this story. He thought, something, he was born this way or whatever. He had no idea that this doctor caused this. And then the doctor said to him that I was so disheartened and so despondent by what I did, I decided to quit my profession and not be a doctor anymore. I couldn't believe, what happened. I couldn't go on. He said, and I knew also that your parents, he said to the rabbi, your parents had every right to sue me, okay, and they probably will and they should because it was my fault. So Rabbi Bucket was amazed by this. And then Rabbi Bucket mentions that his parents were Holocaust survivors. I mean, tragic, tragic stories from both his mother and father's side, tragic tragedies that they lived through and experienced. And now they have this child that this doctor did this to, and they're living through this now. And then the doctor said, when your parents heard, Rabbi Bucket's parents heard, that this doctor was going to give up his practice and were afraid he's going to be sued and everything else, Rabbi Bucket's parents approached the doctor. And they said to him, the Eibishter is the one above in Yiddish, God. The Eibishter is in charge. There are no accidents. You should continue being a doctor. We want you to continue your practice. We have no interest in suing you. The Eibishter is in charge. And then they said to him and demanded from him that he deliver all their future children. And he looked at Rabbi Bucket and said, I delivered you and your 8 siblings before you. I heard this story, and little did I know, the very next day I heard the news, and probably at the time I heard this story, it was going on, that October 7th, I heard this story. The atrocities and the massacre and the second Holocaust of the Jewish people was taking place in the land of Israel. And how do we even come to grips with what we heard, the details, and what took place and what we're still living through? I wish and pray I had the mindset, the faith, the emuna, the bitachon, the security, the mindset of Rabbi Bucket's parents to realize that the Eibishter is in charge, that I'm not in charge of this world. Because if I'm in charge of this world, I won't be able to sleep at night. But there is a God, and this God is in charge of this world. And there are things that maybe will be revealed to us, maybe they won't be revealed to us. Okay? But we don't understand. And we have to understand that we don't understand. That's the first step. But to realize the Eibishter is in charge. And so the story of Rabbi Bucket has allowed me to somehow get grips with waking up every day and realizing that I'm not in charge of it. You know, there's in Washington, D.C., there's the Holocaust Museum. If you've ever been to it, at the end of the museum on the tour, there's videos of testimonials from Holocaust survivors. And one of the videos has a person saying that when he was in Auschwitz, the death camp, there was an argument, two Jews. One was praying in Auschwitz. And the other Jew saying, what are you praying for? What's the matter with you? They're killing us. They're killing our parents. What are you praying for? He says, I'm thanking God. He said, they're killing our parents. They're killing our children. They're killing our people. They're slaughtering us. They're gassing us. They're shooting us. They're killing us. What could you possibly be thanking God for? And he said, I'm thanking God that we are not the ones doing the killing. Elie Wiesel said, there is evil in the world. There is evil. It will always exist. But we have a life of being the ones who are either killing, or we can have the life of the ones who unfortunately sometimes are killed. Okay. And the Jews have a moral code. There is a moral code. And that's what we got at Mount Sinai, this moral code, that we should not be the ones doing the killing. We should thank our God every day that, thank God, we could have been born into Hamas. We could have been born into ISIS. We could have been born into that atmosphere and environment. Okay? But we have the privilege of being born into a different moral code where, yes, the evil will sometimes try to kill us. The difference between the first Holocaust and the second Holocaust is we now have Tzahal, we have Israel Defense Forces. And we have an army that can fight this evil and is fighting this evil. And we're losing many good soldiers and many good Jews for it. But that's what we're doing. We have Tzahal. But how do we fight? Okay, how do we fight? Some of our children might be in Israel. Some might be fighting in Israel. We have doctors who went over there and tried to help. But we're sitting here in Atlanta, and I'm in Florida, and I go to other places all throughout the world. What do we do? What can we do? We have to do something. We can't just sit here. I spoke about my daughter before. When we moved out of Long Island to move to Florida, we sold the house. And, you know, inside the contract, when you sell a house, it tells you when you have to get out of the house. Yeah. You know, it says midnight by a certain date. Now, normal people are out of the house a week before, 2 weeks before, a few days before. My family, it's 10 minutes to midnight, and we're for schlepping stuff on the truck. You know, we got 5 minutes left. Let's go. You know, we're taking stuff. We're putting things in. We're pushing it, you know. And as we're going through everything, I find in the corner of the garage, you know, in the corner, a box. It's actually like a pilot's case. You know, those, like a big attaché case, but the big one, you know, that pilots carry, like for files. And the second I saw it, I knew what it was. When I was a rabbi, that's where I kept the prayer books for Shiva houses. I'd show up at the Shiva house with some chairs and the books. You know, the rabbi does. He goes there, brings them. You know, and I must have come home one day. By the way, I remember going once to a house, and you go in sometimes to Shiva houses, and it's a very party-like atmosphere sometimes. You know, it's not so set. People are drinking and eating and watching television, and, you know. And I show up with the chairs and the books, and they immediately take the chairs, and they're opening up, and they're all sitting down on the chairs, and they, you know, and I turned out later that it was Super Bowl Sunday. I was in the wrong house. And they really appreciated the chairs. So, you know, they're low to the ground. You can watch television. So but this case with the Shiva books, with the prayer books, I had sitting in my garage. And I said, oh, what am I going to do with them at minutes to midnight, moments to midnight? I have these. I can't throw them out. They're holy books, the prayer books. I can't leave them for the new owners of the house. It's like, hey, a welcome homewarming gift, some Shiva books. Yeah. So I can't put them on the truck because I don't want to take them to Florida, and there was no room left on that truck. I couldn't get another piece of paper in there. And so I said to my teenage kids, go down the block. There's a Reform synagogue, okay, at the end of the block. Drop off my last gift to the community. People, you would always come to my shul and give me books. Rabbi, they give you books that are falling apart. You touch them, your hands are brown for weeks. They're disgusting. And then they want a deduction with a receipt to get a, you know. So here I'm giving them these beautiful books and a beautiful leather case. I'll leave it there tonight. Tomorrow they'll get it and they'll be all happy. They got the prayer books, Shiva book, whatever. So my kids went down the block, dropped it off. Next morning, my daughter and I went to Starbucks. We shouldn't have school. We're moving. So I thought, I'll take her out, father-daughter, you know, time. We've never did that before. She's always in school. So, you know, she'll get a little nice daddy time, you know, bonding, whatever. So we're sitting there, have our Avento latte, grandes, whatever. And we're both drinking and talking to each other and enjoying our company. And the woman who I met at Chabad, actually, a woman comes into the Starbucks. And she says, oh, I heard you guys are moving. I said, yes, we're actually moving today. She said, wow. And then she said, getting out just in time. What are you talking about? She said, didn't you hear? I said, no. She said, well, they found a bomb sitting at the Reform Synagogue. We left overnight. So my daughter says, no, that was, I'm like. So we made nice small talk with the lady and she left. My daughter and I scooted out of the booth, got in the car, And we're driving closer, as close as we can get. There are helicopters flying over. There's yellow tape. There are police cars all over the place. My daughter says, Abba, you have to tell them. Yes. I said, no, there's no way I will tell anybody. Okay, you're very young. You don't understand. She says, Abba, you have to tell them. They're very worried. I said, listen to me. You don't understand things. Okay, we're not telling anybody. This is not even, you shouldn't even know. Okay, so we get, I said, oh, let me get closer. We get closer. And I get as close as I can get till a policeman stops me, bangs on the window. He says, gotta move it along. I open the window and I said, I have information with regard to the bomb. So he gets on his thing. Gets me out of the car. My daughter stays in the car. He brings me around the back of the shul. There are RVs. You know, the recreation vehicle for the police and the whatever, bomb squad, they're all there. Some guy, the door swings open, guy walks out, he looks like he's the commander of NATO, okay? He's got the whole thing on, he walks over to me. I understand you have information regarding the incendiary device. And I then look over at the door for the shul, and there's my nebuch, my poor little shiva box sitting there, all by itself, like, oh, you can vote. And then coming at it is a robot. And I'm like, oh, I can't take it anymore. I go running over to it. I open it up. I say, they're prayer books. Everybody was relieved. I was a little embarrassed. I got a $200 receipt for deduction. And I thought I would never tell anybody this story, I have to tell you, let alone, you know, a group. And then, I mean, nothing good can come out of this story, you know. But then I heard the Lubavitcher Rebbe talk about the word vayigash. Vayigash. It's a Hebrew word. It means, and he approached. And it has to do with when you approach in water, in war, in battle. And he approached in battle. That's a word we use when we approach in battle. And then he said, we also use it, the same word, when we approach in prayer. It's kind of odd. Approaching in battle is, you know, fierce and gruesome and strong. Prayer is serene and sweet and kind and peaceful. How could you use the same word for the both types of approaching? And the fact is, the Rebbe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe says that when it comes to our prayers, we should be approaching just like we're approaching in battle. We have to be exacting. We have to be specific. We have to be strong. We have to aim. It's not just, oh, amen, and leave it like that. We have to go in there. And I think there are two wars being fought right now in Israel, for Israel. One is Tzahal, the IDF is fighting. And they're also putting on tzitzis and yarmulkes and going into battle. Okay. And we have to fight the other war. It's a spiritual war. And I can guarantee you, Israel has not been around for thousands and thousands of years and outlived the Hittites, the Jebusites, the blah, 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 all these other people, okay, just because we have an Iron Dome. We didn't have one back then. It's because we have a spiritual war we've been fighting. And even the Iron Dome, by the way, how do you say Iron Dome in Hebrew? Anybody know? Kipat Barzel. Kipat, are you from Israel?
No, my dad is.
Your dad is very nice. You know, when I was in Los Angeles, I was in California, and I said, how do you say Iron Dome in Hebrew? And some guy in the back row went, Kipat Barzel. So I said, oh, are you from Israel? He said, no, what's the matter with you? I'm from Los Angeles. Israelis are very tough, thank God. So Kipat Barzel is the word for Iron Dome. You hear on television, they say, Israel has the Iron Dome that protects the, you know. Kipat Barzel. Kipah Barzel. It means the steel yarmulke. That's what it is. The rest of the world thinks it's an iron dome. It translates steel yarmulke. There is a steel yarmulke over Israel. One that's used machinery that we have, and the other is our steel yarmulke that we have. We have a spiritual war we have to fight. And when we pray, we have to pray with that type of precision, that type of exacting of what we want and what we want to happen, and to save our people, our hostages. We want to defeat the enemy. Okay, it's not natural for us. We're speaking with the Rebbetzin today. It's not natural for us to want to kill other people. We're the ones who get killed. We're not the killers. Okay, but in this case, we have to survive. Okay, and we're being forced to be in this situation. But we have to do it exactingly. It can't be done lackadaisically, even our prayers. Our prayers have to be that strong. So we have to do vayigash, the strong physical battle. And our prayer books, and I hope this funny little story I told you, which is true, are our explosives. They are our bombs, okay? And that story with picking up their prayer books, the whole bomb squad was there staring at a prayer book. And I thought to myself, yeah, that's how powerful they are. That's how powerful. And we have to realize that. We come to shul, we come to the synagogue to pray. Maybe we didn't use, not usually a prayer goer. We don't go to synagogue all the time. We should come. Pick up that explosive prayer book and start praying. Because thank God we don't have to go into Gaza, and thank God our children necessarily don't have to go. All we have to do is come to the synagogue, open our prayer book, and pray together and with precision. I will tell you this. There's a lot of negativity. We feel very downtrodden about it all. You know, the whole world is against us. They're all protesting. There was today someplace in Atlanta, there was a protest of some pro-Palestinian protest. You know, when my wife and I sit in the backyard in Boca Raton, Florida, and we live on the golf course, which is another thing. You know, you can't take children in the backyard because there are men all day long cursing, breaking the clubs, cursing, screaming. You know, this is how you play golf, apparently. You hit the ball and then you curse. So anyway, we were sitting in the backyard and we're watching, you know, looking at our beautiful backyard, beautiful scenery. And what do? We look at the weeds over there. Oh, look at the screen is a little there. Oh, look, this has to be chopped and pruned. And with this beautiful backyard. And what do? We're looking at the weeds. And I think we do that also. Look what we have. We have a land of Israel. We have Jewish people. We actually have the entire world. Some are shtunkers that are trying to say we're bad. But amazingly, there are so many good people, Jews and Christians, coming together in support of Israel. We have to look at that beauty. We can't just sit back and say, oh, everybody's against us. This is all terrible and this is terrible. There's some great things going on. And I will tell you, even in the stories from Germany, from the Holocaust, every story of a Jew that was saved and lived, there's always a story of a Christian who helped save that Jew. Okay, it wasn't just Oskar Schindler and he did enough. He did plenty. But there's a lot of Oskar Schindlers, a lot of good people, a lot of Christians who are looking to help us and do that. And the story that comes to mind was in Germany on the bus. There was a Jewish woman on a bus. There's a true story. She wrote the story. She's on the bus and she doesn't have her papers. And if the Nazis find her, they will take her away and they will kill her. And she's sitting there, and sure enough, the bus stops. The bus is filled with Germans, and she's the only Jew sitting there, the back of the bus. And the Nazis come on board to look for papers. And she starts to shake. She wrote this. So I started shaking. I actually started crying. And this German, big German man next to her, sitting there, looks at her, says, "What's wrong with you?" She says, "I'm Jewish. I don't have the papers. They're going to take me away. They'll put me in a concentration camp. They'll kill me. They'll take me away from my family. I don't have any papers." And with that, immediately, this big German man stood up and pointed at her and said, "You stupid woman! You stupid, stupid woman!" And the Nazis came running down the aisle of the bus. "So what's going on?" And he said, "My stupid wife forgot her papers again. Here are my papers." And the Nazis laughed and said, "Yeah, stupid woman." He walked off. And she writes in the story that she didn't even know his name and never saw him again. Story after story of people that are supporters of Jews throughout our history, that we have to realize, stop looking at the weeds. They're there. But there's a lot of beauty and a lot of great things going on, a lot of unity between the Jewish people that are going on as well. You know, I have to say this, talking about the unity of Jewish people. You know, the first temple in Jerusalem was destroyed in 586 BCE by Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians. And why? Because they were anti-Semites. And what did we do? We rebuilt the temple. Anti-Semites, dime a dozen. They have it throughout. The second temple was destroyed because of Jew hating another Jew, because Jews didn't get along. And the third temple has not been rebuilt. That temple is still unbuilt because that takes a little more energy. Fighting anti-Semites, all right. But for Jews, our people, to get along and to be together, that takes a much different angle. And I'll tell you, there is one word. You know, they say when a Jew meets another Jew, they're already arguing. Y.Y. Jacobson actually says it. He says one Jew says Shalom Aleichem and the other Jew says Aleichem Shalom. He says they're already arguing. Shalom Aleichem, Aleichem Shalom. So, you know, but there's one word, which can help solve the problem of Jewish unity. And the word is a Yiddish word. Anybody speak Yiddish? Yeah. It's a Yiddish word. Don't worry, I won't call on you. You. The word is kvetch. What does kvetch mean?
Complain.
Yeah, most people think complain. Yeah. But the word kvetch really means, you know what kvetch really, really means? It means kvetch. Actually, when I was in England and I said, what does kvetch mean? A woman said, it means whinge. I'm like, what is she talking about? What is whinge? And then everybody in the room looked at each other and said, oh, yes, definitely whinge, definitely. I'm like, they're all crazy. You know, what language are they speaking? So kvetch means squeeze. If everyone can put their cell phones away, if you have your cell phone out, it's very distracting to me. So kvetch means squeeze. Squeeze. Kvetch. We kvetch something. We squeeze it. I only know that word because my grandfather, Olav Shalom Nathan, who came to this country, sole survivor from the Holocaust, he opened a fruit and vegetable store in the Bronx. And he spent his entire life saying one sentence. Don't kvetch the fruit. Don't kvetch the fruit. Please, don't kvetch the fruit. Don't kvetch the fruit. Because we know what we do. We pick up a perfectly good peach. In 3 days, right now it's a little hard. In 3 days, this peach is going to be the juiciest peach we ever had. Right now it's not ready, but 3 days will be. And what do? We give it a kvetch. And then we kvetch this side. Then we kvetch here. Then we kvetch here. And then we look and go, this one's no good. And we go for the next one. And that's what we do with Jews. We do with each other. There's a Jew out there. I'll tell you, right now he's not, and she's not ready for you. But at some point, she's going to be the juiciest Jew you ever had in your life. We're going to love this Jew. Oh, I love this Jew. Okay, but right now, not so much. But what do? We kvetch. Oh, look at him. He does this. He does that. He stands. He walks. He talks. All right, beard. No beard. Stop kvetching the Jews. Leave it. Be more unity. You know, the thing that came out of, everyone talks about this terrible atrocity that took place on October 7th, is that the Jews in Israel stopped kvetching each other. The Hasidic Jews showing up with food for soldiers. You had soldiers putting on tzitzis and yarmulkes. You had the transformed what took place. We don't understand this. It's not that that's why it happened and that's what should happen and it's a good thing. But it gives us a message that we have to stop kvetching the Jews. We have to be together. You know, there's I have the book that I wrote that it's put me on this tour around the world again is called I Never Met the Rebbe Many Times. Okay, I never met the Rebbe many times. That's all very interesting stories, I'm going to have copies. I only brought a number of copies with me, and I could afterwards put your Hebrew name inside if you'd like, and I'll sign it. And I'll probably, in the back of the room, only have a number of copies, but you should come and get a copy. I'll sign it, and if you want it for a gift for someone else, we'll do that also. But my first book was called David's Harp. And in David's Harp, it was... articles like Art Buchwald and Irma Bombeck wrote, you know, these kind of things. But I have a poem inside this, and it's called David's Harp because I had a column that David, I harped on things, and King David had a harp. It's a great title, but I have to explain it every time. So, but on what I was just talking about, about Jews and everything else, there's one poem in here, a very short poem I wanted to share with you. And the short poem is called Name Calling. And I think you'll get it. The liberals call them conservatives. And the hardliners call them leftists. The freethinkers call them closed-minded, and the open-minded call them reconstructionists. The traditionalists call them renewal, and the orthodox call them chiloni. The secularists call them right-wing, and the reform call them haredi. The observant call them apikores, and the modern call them black hat. The non-observant call them religious nuts, and the suruga call them ultra-this and ultra-that. The kibbutzniks call them chasidim, and the settlers call them mesorati. The progressives call them Zionists, and the conservatives call them dati. The religious call them balchuva, and the zealots call them true. The Shomer Shabbos call them Machalel, and the anti-Semites just call them Jew. So, yeah, you can clap, but I'm not done. I do want to say, I'm coming to the end. You know what they say? I said it last night. I said they say Gentiles say goodbye. Gentiles leave without saying goodbye, and Jews say goodbye and never leave. You know, what I wanted to say is, listen. There's something to be learned from everything. Purim is coming up. We have 2 months of supposed to be joyous for 2 months. Purim is coming up, and there's Haman and Mordechai. Haman's the bad guy, Mordechai's the good guy. Sometimes Mordechai can talk on the bima all he wants over and over again in shul, and nobody hears anything. One Haman goes, I'm going to kill the Jews. Every Jew gets up, I'm feel Jewish. Okay? There's a reason is that Haman does his work also. Hamas did some of their work also. They got some people revved up to realize they're Jewish. But also Hamas can teach us something. I don't want to hate to say they could teach us something because they're such evil people. But you know what they could teach us? They could teach us how to teach. Now, not what they're teaching. They're teaching evil to their children. But they're teaching it day and night. They're teaching it when they lie down and when they wake up. They're teaching it when they walk by the way and when they come home. They teach it by the doorpost. They teach it when they eat. They teach it when they finished eating. They teach it all the time. That's what they're teaching their children, the evil. What we do is, you want to go to Hebrew school this week? Nah, I don't feel like it. Okay, I'll go next week. We have a different attitude of teaching, okay? You know, want to go to shul? Nah, I'll go Rosh Hashanah. Maybe not this Rosh Hashanah, next Rosh Hashanah. We have to learn. You have to teach. And you have to teach and teach and teach. And it's not just a one time. You have to teach over and over and over again, always, your children, your grandchildren. You have to teach and teach. There are three things we're supposed to teach our children. Anybody know the three things? One is, yes?
Swim.
Oh, yes, the third thing. What's the first one?
Torah.
Teach Torah. Second is a vocation. Okay, makes sense. Teach them how to get a job, right? And teach them Torah, Bible. And the third is teach them how to swim. Very good. And so swim, what's the story? They teach them how to swim? I mean, that sounds like Torah vocation. It seems more important than swimming. But in a world where, I don't know, 75% of the earth is water, it's a good thing to teach them how to swim. I thought, okay, makes sense. But it's got to be something more. And I think what it is when you teach someone to swim, anybody ever taught their child to swim, you don't go like this. The pool is over there. Go in there and move your arms. No. You get in the water and you stand there and you put your head on the water. And then the child puts his head in the water. And then you move your own arms and you swim a little and they swim. You have to personally immerse yourself in the water to teach swimming. It is needed. It is required when you teach swimming to actually go and immerse yourself also. And it teaches us how to teach everything else. How to teach Torah, how to teach work ethic. Okay, you have to do that also. We have to immerse ourselves in things that we want to teach our children. And it teaches us how to teach. You can't just say, oh, we'll drop you off at the synagogue, but we're going to go off to the mall. No, you have to immerse yourself also. And when they see you immersing yourself, they won't be scared. They'll jump in also and they'll stick their head on the water also and enjoy what swimming has. So it's very important for us to do that as well. Those are the three things. I'm going to conclude with something a little different. Education, I think, ultimately, is what has made us survive all these years. Okay, teaching. If there's a song, a theme song from the Holocaust, if there was such a thing, a theme song from the Holocaust, it wasn't a song about being courageous and fighting and doing this. It was a song, a simple song. Even Steven Spielberg used it. A simple song about a teacher teaching a child the Aleph Beis, the alphabet, the A, B, C. That's the theme song of our Holocaust. That's the theme song of our survival. And sometimes we teach it inside the home, and sometimes it's taught by a rabbi or by a parent, and sometimes it's next to the fireplace, or it's next to what they call the Pripichik. Eifen Pripichik brennt feieru und stiebis heis. Und der Rebbe lehrt in kleine Kinderlach, dem Aleph Beis. Und der Rebbe lehrt in kleine Kinderlach, dem Aleph Beis. Sog je Kinderlach, gedenk je Teiere, was il derin do? Sog je noch amol, und take noch amol, kumitz Aleph O. On the hearth burned a little flame, and it warmed the room, and the rabbi taught the little children the Aleph Beis, and the rabbi taught the little children the Aleph Beis. Listen, children, my dear ones, to what you learn right here. Say it once again and over once again. Kumitz Alepho, oifen Pripichik, brennt a fire, und stieb is haze. The way we fight anti-Jewish is by doing Jewish. Have a good week. Thank you.